Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Tuesday, June the 4th, 2019. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at MetsMorizedOnline.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media, and you get the show on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. I hope everybody's doing well. Come to you a little later than normal. Figured I had a chance after the long West Coast trip to take a day or two, marinate on the trip, some of the things that happened, see if there's any news that popped up, and then come to you right before the Mets start a six-game homestand and a pretty important stretch. Ten home games out of the next 12 with a home, with an off day in between, where they're going to really need to make some hay. Joining me over the weekend, I had a chance to catch up with, haven't talked to him in a long time, but Matthew Silverman has authored books, a ton of books, a book about the 73 Mets, but a recent book that has just come out is about Shea Stadium. Shea Stadium remembered the Mets, the Jets, and Beatlemania. We'll get a chance to talk to Matt. And with the Mets coming home and the summer ahead of us, and also a chance to realize that it's been over 10 years, over 10 years since Shea Stadium was demolished. But Citi Field is 10 years old, and no one's really talking about it. The year that the Mets are celebrating 1969, Citi Field is 10 years old. So Matt will talk about his project, going back and looking at the history of Shea Stadium, some of the things he learned, get his thoughts on Citi Field. Chance to just take a step away from the grind of the baseball season and have a fun segment with a well-known author, a big Mets fan, and somebody that I think all of you probably know and have enjoyed his work at some point. Now, about a week ago, I came to you right before the Memorial Day holiday, and we were talking about the replacement Mets. They had just come off a 6-1 homestand, and can they survive the West? And I had told you that if I could sign for 3-4 now, looking at some of the gaps in the offense, the struggles with the starting rotation, knowing they're going into LA to face the Dodgers, the best hitting team in baseball, a team that was hot, and then going into Arizona, a team that's plucky on their home field, I would have. And I still stand by that. The shame of it all is that the Mets were two bad innings away from coming home with a 4-win road trip. And this podcast, and I think the narrative that's out there in the media, would be so different. That's amazing how things work in sports. And sometimes how we have to step back and have some context, because two bad innings, an historically bad ninth inning with Edwin Diaz, nobody would have predicted that against LA, and then a bad eighth inning, perhaps a mismanaged bullpen eighth inning in Arizona on Saturday night. I think a lot of ways that one, I think, stuck in everyone's craw a little bit more, because you could debate the bullpen management. When Diaz loses, when Diaz gets hit, at that point you just shrug your shoulders and say, hey, had a bad game. But the one on Saturday, I think, is the one that really stuck in everyone's craw. And the difference between, quote-unquote, I hate to say this, mission accomplished, because 3-4 is not a great mission, and coming home, and the questions have started up again. Joel Sherman wrote a piece yesterday about Mickey Callaway. Mickey, you know, basically Mickey, for the first time, maybe in his tenure, showed some agitation and anger towards his team in the postgame. Funny, that's the one time that there's no audio that I could find to hear Mickey's words. But he said basically, I think, what all of us have said in one way or another. It's time for them to either put up and be the team that we think they can be, or get out of the way. And, you know, The road trip is a synopsis of the season where it's so close yet so far. You have two bad innings that could have made it for a 4-3 road trip, a split in L.A. and a win in Arizona. And you look at it, it's so far because all season you can say if this, if that, you know, even Familia, who has been bad this year, is a synopsis of the season where he'll come in and, like he did against Avila in the seventh inning, after DeGrom came out, he'll look vintage Familia. And then he comes out and he hits a batter and he gives up a hit and he looks clunky and uncomfortable. He looks like a guy that's, you know, in a sweat box that he needs some AC, that's like, you know, he's, you know, tugging on himself and trying to figure out his mechanics. It's almost uncomfortable to watch him. It's painful to watch him, even for that one inning. So it's a synopsis, and now really we'll find out whether there's going to be some meaningful baseball the rest of the year, because the time is now. You've got three against San Francisco. You've got three against Colorado. They go to Yankee Stadium for two games against a team that, similar to the Dodgers, is hot. It's a buzzsaw. And then you got a four-game series against a very good Cardinals team that gave the Mets a ton of trouble earlier this year when they were playing well. And then they go on another road trip, and this road trip is even more meaningful in the sense where they're playing the Braves, they're playing the Phillies, they go to Chicago before they come home at the end of June to play Atlanta at Citi Field. And probably by the road trip, we'll know what this team is about. This team is three games under, and I can't see any scenario with the next 12 games where they got to kind of go 8-4. I mean, I think they've got to get to that road trip above 500. That would put them at a game above 500. Nothing sexy, by the way. And that's why this hurts so much, because if you had won the two games, if you had came home at 500 or maybe even above, you look at things and say, look, you know, you got to come here. It's an important homestand. But I think it's almost critical for them to get to the road trip above 500. And that's going to be 8-4 against, you know, teams like the Cardinals and the Yankees in the middle, the Yankees at Yankee Stadium with a two-game set. It's, you know, these are not rollover teams. The Rockies are playing better. The Giants are always a team when you have a matchup like against Bumgarner, like you have tonight. You never know how, you know, a guy like that could come in and dominate. And then the Cardinals are a team that, you know, have a ton of offense. You know, Adam Wainwright almost threw a no-hitter the other day. Nothing's going to be a given, but we'll see how the Mets season comes and what comes out of it over the next 2 weeks. I think in 2 weeks, right around Father's Day, I think we'll really have a feel of where this thing is going. And then the question is, the conversation will turn is, what's next? Because for the past 2 years, when the Mets have struggled and they've had these June swoons and it looked and it was clear they weren't going anywhere in that given season, I kept telling you, hey, you got to stay the course. You have to be able to realize that you have this pitching. They've made some mistakes. Some free agents didn't work out, injuries, whatever it may be. But you need to stay the course. And I still believe that. And I don't know if ripping this team to the studs is going to happen anyway, not with the way the general manager came in and the way he talked, but there will be changes, and I think there'll be some thought about ripping the rotation apart if this team in the next 2 weeks stumbles and continues to play sub-500 baseball. It'll be a question about what the direction they will go, who are the core players that they'll stick with going forward, and how can they continue to honor the mandate that they put together, which was compete now, compete in the future. You saw a little bit about that last night. We're not going to get into the draft today because we'll have a draft show later in the week, but had a chance to get a couple of high school bats, Brody Van Wagenen's first draft. So we won't know about how that turns out for a few years, but Mets have already started to begin the process of restockpiling their farm system that they pulled away from over the winter to put a team together that competes. But ultimately, can they use, and I think the two names that are going to be key to the next 2 weeks, but also could potentially be a conversation in July, will be Zach Wheeler and Noah Syndergaard. Now, I know Noah Syndergaard has some more years of control. Zach Wheeler is a free agent, but eventually the Mets have to think, if they're going to restock things, or this season's not going to go well, and you still want to compete going into 2020, I think that those two guys are two names that will be widely talked about two contenders who may need to add to their rotation and may be willing to give up something. And the Mets have to be careful because with Wheeler, he's a free agent. So at the end, you don't know what he's going to, you know, where he's going to be next year if you hold on to him, unless you want to try to sign him to an extension. And look, there's some concerns with that because Wheeler still has, and I was talking to a scout over the weekend that was at the game on Friday night, and he even said, he goes, look, the guy is always dragging. There's still those concerns about the elbow. You know, things like that always can lead to another arm problem or potentially down the road a shoulder problem. And as you get into his 30s and you sign him to a long-term deal, the risk gets even greater. When he was a young pitcher, there's no risk for the Mets to lose 2 years. It's a shame they lost 2 years of Zach Wheeler in his cost control years over to injury. You wish that happens. Never happens to a pitcher, but it happens later on when he gets expensive and you get some mileage out of the cost-controlled years. But, you know, that's a risk. Now, Syndergaard's different because if you trade him and he rediscovers himself, and he's still trying to rediscover himself, and he battled in L.A., and I'm not ready to give up on Noah Syndergaard, you're going to be facing him over the next few years and say, geez, if we had just held on for a couple of more years. But with the right deal, with a deal that brings some young players that are close to major league ready, that can have an impact, whether they be young pitchers. You start the cycle all over again. Maybe you start the cycle with DeGrom at the top of the rotation and some young up-and-comers that Wheeler and Syndergaard used to be, with Mats kind of being that guy in the middle there. And then you go out and you get some veterans to round out the rotation, and maybe you have some, or you trade them for some offensive pieces, and then you go out and you get some veterans to build a different rotation, a team more balanced or a team more focused on offense and less on balanced starting pitching, guys that could be professionals and get you through six innings rather than guys that potentially could dominate but seem to always leave you wanting. And maybe that's ultimately the situation here, that managing expectations, like I talk about all the time, has been something that we're not doing with this staff. Maybe this is as good as they can be. Maybe Mats is going to be a little too above league average pitcher. Maybe Syndergaard was a flash in the pan. Wheeler, he's a guy that's good, but he's also going to be somewhat inconsistent. And within a game may give you that one bad inning, sort of like what used to happen to Cid Fernandez back in the day. So we'll see. I talked about the rotation stepping up, and I think to a certain degree they did on the trip. I still think there's room to be better. The offense, to me, continues, even with the replacements, to be a team that could score 4 to 5 runs a game. Plenty of offense to beat the teams, even teams like L.A. that they were facing on the road. And look, with the bullpen, which had been good going into the road trip, that's where this team has struggled probably for the better part of a decade to get it right. And I think a lot of teams right now are struggling to get it right. And if Familia is going to be bad, then it's going to be hard to see this team being able to navigate the late innings. The problem you have there is Gazelman. I still wonder if he's more long reliever starter than guy that you want to go to late in a game with high leverage situations. Lugo is a guy I would like to go to, but if he can't go back-to-back days consistently, and we'll see because he just did get off the disabled list, injured list, I'm sorry, then you have to start to consider that Lugo will be a starter, because if he can't go back-to-back out of the bullpen, then you got a situation where either you have an opener that you can use, or you got to find a way to go into that rotation. And the injury he had, the tendonitis, which was a big bicep tendonitis, is a precursor. And you know he's got the slightly torn UCL. Does tell you there's some ligament issues going in there. We know he has a partially torn ligament. Eventually, that probably will tear. And I think the Mets are trying to get as much mileage out of him before that does. And hopefully it never does. And maybe he manages it for the rest of his career. But I think that that's something that they have to take a look at. But it starts tonight. Madison Bumgarner, Noah Syndergaard, 10 home games in 12 days. The Mets have to go 8-4 on this stretch. If they do that, they get to that very critical road trip. And then that'll be the next conversation. It'll be a very similar conversation to what we had going into the West. They have to go out there and they have to be ready to compete and win, which they have not done on the road. They've done a pretty good job at home of that. They have done a horrible job on the road, which is kind of against what they've been over the last couple of years. Get healthy. Get Cano back. Get McNeil back. That solidifies and rounds out the roster. It will be interesting to see how they handle the depth on the roster, because Cano and McNeil are going to mean maybe goodbye to Echeverria. I'm sure Altair will be the next one to go. You know, Matt Kemp is at AAA. What's his status to bring a right-handed bat up to this team? So there's a lot of questions coming up. We'll have some more answers later in the week. We'll definitely get into the draft. I know there was the draft yesterday, so I'm not even going to get into that today. I just wanted to kind of recap the trip. You guys all know what the situation is. And again, I'm standing by what I said. It's a very disappointing trip. And the dangerous part for Mickey Callaway now, where I said they're probably going to have him as a manager for the rest of the year. But the dangerous thing is, if you start to lose the players, that's when this thing will go and spiral out of the way. Got a little discontent with Wilson Ramos with this. Is he not going to ever catch Jacob DeGrom? It seems like it's still kind of lingering out there. At least the media is making it that way. DeGrom not happy about being pulled and the over-conservative nature of handling his injury. Mets have been conservative at injuries under this new regime from day one, and I think that's a conscious decision that they've made. So if you start to see the players crack, that's when Mickey's job is in jeopardy. I stand by what I said 2 weeks ago. They're going to be who they're going to be this year, and I think that that's going to be the case, whether it's Callaway, Riggleman, and I find it hard to believe that you could get your long-term replacement outside the organization now. I don't think you should make a move until you have your long-term or the guy that you think will be the long-term solution in-house now. So you usually don't do that in the middle of the season. Could happen, but very unlikely. So you stick with it, and every time they lose two or three in a row, the media is going to circle. Joel Sherman's going to have those articles where everybody continues to say he should have went to Kansas City or Baltimore to cut his teeth before he came here, and he's not ready for New York. And I'm not saying they're totally unfair. I'm just saying at this point, let's let this play out, and let's not do a postmortem while the guy's still in the job, because it just comes across like everybody's looking to push him out and get him fired. And is it a surprise to see Mickey, who has made his whole tenure about supporting the players and being positive, go so negative on Sunday? Yes. But it was clear after they took the second gut-punching loss on Saturday night that this team came out very dead on Sunday and maybe not ready to compete and was looking more to getting out of the West Coast and going home. And that's a concern. And if I'm Mickey Callaway, that's a reason to lay into them. And again, we don't know how he treats these guys behind closed doors. Just because he goes to the media and presents a certain front does not mean that that's who he is behind closed doors. We're assuming. And let's remember, there have been managers in this town that have gone through the cauldron and have come out on the other end. Joe Girardi was one of them. Joe Girardi, and myself included, when I used to cover both teams at the old NYBaseballDigest.com, I thought he should have been fired by two or three times earlier in his tenure. And the media circled the wagon, just like this, like with Callaway. And he came out, and he survived, and he won a championship. And even after he won a championship, there was still that thought that he was the wrong guy for the job to get the most out of that veteran bunch. And here you go, and the guy wound up lasting 10 years in the position. So you never know what could happen. But I do know that the next 12 games is pretty much where this team is going to make hay, where they're going to set themselves up for their next test, and then maybe the first test that they'll pass on the road later this June. And then it'll be very soon before we know the direction of where this is going and what the team should do. And that hopefully will be, we continue to talk about them competing for a playoff spot. But if not, then it'll get really interesting about us talking about what will they do to move forward. Because that question, in my mind, is not as clear as it's been in prior years. It's actually much more murky than ever. And it's much trickier, and it's much more critical to get it right. Let's take a quick break. When we return, Shea Stadium Remembered, Matthew Silverman will join us as we talk about his new project, his book, The Mets, the Jets, and Beatlemania. You're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. We'll be back with more right after this.
It's goodbye to the Polo Grounds. Farewell to the old, and welcome to the new. Shea Stadium, the new home of the Mets, to be ready for the opening day of the 1964 season. Here is a stadium that has been designed to be the greatest ever built for baseball, with a perfect view of the playing field from every seat. Not a column, pillar, or post in the entire park to obstruct the view. 55,000 seats, and nearly all of them within the foul lines. Everything about this stadium has been designed for the comfort and convenience of the fans. a series of ingeniously arranged ramps to avoid jamming of crowds before or after game time. 21 banks of escalators make the long, hard climb to the upper grandstands a thing of the past. There's a subway line that runs right to the ballpark, with a pedestrian overpass that leads from the Willits Point IRT station right to the stadium entrance. Bus lines, too, will go directly to the stadium. And nearby is a station of the Long Island Railroad.
We're back, and joining us is author of a new book, Shea Stadium Remembered, The Mets, the Jets, and Beatlemania. You guys know him also for a book about the 73 Mets and 100 Things Mets Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. It's Matthew Silverman at Met Silverman on Twitter. Matt, it's a pleasure to have you on. How you doing on this weekend Sunday?
I'm doing very well, thanks.
So, Shea Stadium. As I was going through the book, and I looked at the date, I'm like, I can't believe it's been over a decade since Shea Stadium was demolished. Citi Field's been around 10 years. I guess it's kind of amazing, and I'm sure that played into you putting this book together, how time flies and how long it's been. How you know, Citi Field being 10 years old, that's not a young stadium anymore.
No, and, you know, run into people and – they've never, you know, they never went to Shea Stadium, or they didn't, you know, all their memories are of Citi Field, or, you know, they just happen to not have really been much to either, because so many people experience the game now in different ways than you or I probably grew up doing it. And it's interesting what people's thoughts are. And I have experienced a lot of people that 10 years actually mellows out some of people's memories of it and turns them from nostalgia to from nausea to nostalgia in some cases.
That's absolutely right. And before I get to Shea Stadium and some of the memories that you put together in this great book, are you a fan of Citi Field? I know it's a different ballpark, and it's had its issues, maybe from a dimension standpoint after it was opened up that they've worked on. But what are your thoughts about Citi Field, being that now you've dived in and lived through, about 50 years of Shea Stadium?
I like Citi Field. It's a nice ballpark. It's, one of the more interesting, newer parks. It reminds me a lot of Citizens Bank Ballpark. I know some Mets fans won't want to hear that, but it's very similar, it seems to me. And, it has some nice touches of different things. And I run into a lot of Yankees fans who say they like it much more than they like the new Yankee Stadium. So, the backhand, I'll take the backhanded compliment. And I've been there a lot, but, you know, to be honest, it's just not really the same because I didn't grow up there. And, you know, the game has changed a little bit in the way people appreciate it has, too.
Absolutely. Matt Silverman, author of the book Shea Stadium Remembered, is joining me here. You talk about after 10 years, you know, everybody was ready, I think. I think there was some old-timers that were really, like, nostalgic about Shea Stadium. But there are a number of people who are ready for a new ballpark, a ballpark with more amenities. You know, everybody seemed around the league to be getting newer, better ballparks, and the Mets were playing in this 1960s football/baseball stadium. But as you look to the history of Shea, and you did a really thorough job in this book, you went through, you know, from its inception all the way through to some of the great events. It wasn't as bad, I guess, as everybody thought. Is that a fair way to put it on? Maybe it was you don't appreciate something until it's gone.
Yeah, you know, I never really had a problem with it, in any way myself. I mean, there were parts of it that weren't great. You knew you weren't going to get, the best food that was available, that was offered. And once you'd gone to other new ballparks and had all the stuff they had, it did make Shea seem a little wanting. But I was fortunate to get a nice bit of time with Howie Rose explaining to me what it was like when he was a kid, and Shea was pretty new. And, he's like, I went there to watch the game. He's like, I would bring a sandwich. I didn't worry about food. He had $2, went through all of the expenses that it required to get into the place. And, he wasn't worried about the food. He still isn't, and there's a lot of people that are like that. And, you know, a lot of modern ball fans have more concerns than what's going on in the game.
What did you learn doing this project about Shea Stadium that you didn't know going into it?
Well, I have to say I learned a lot about the Jets. I had been, you know, been to the I think I'd only made it to actually one Jets game, but I it was a great game, and I actually got to write about that as well during the year they made the playoffs after not having been in for like 10 years. And I learned a lot about them, and actually a lot about how Shea Stadium played a key role in not just the Jets development, but in the AFL, that the moment they moved into Shea, they suddenly were drawing 55,000 people when at the Polo Grounds, they were barely drawing 5,500. And, you know, when they signed Joe Namath, that and some other events sort of led to the amendment or agreement that put the AFL and NFL together and led to the Super Bowl and all the stuff we have today. And, you know, learned about a bunch of different Mets stuff. Skip Lockwood's book I came across while I was researching this, and was an inside pitch. And I never really spent much time in the underneath part. You know, when I went out to the bullpens, they didn't really encourage you to go out there, or you know, when with a press pass and all that, or I just didn't do it for whatever reason. And he really explained it great, and how, you know, you could just drive like a golf cart they would take out to the bullpens and everything like that. And just sort of the way it, you know, everything was so symmetrical there that you don't see anymore. And that was something that I never really thought about. And, you know, was kind of grooved. I actually put in a whole new chapter in the book based on, you know, on that revelation I came across.
Matt Silverman, author of the book Shea Stadium Remembered, is joining me. Great book. Like I said earlier, 10 plus years since Citi Field's been open, since Shea Stadium's been demolished, and it's a really great read, and it goes through the history of that ballpark, not just with the Mets, with a bunch of other stuff, the Jets and other non-sports events. For me, what was interesting, Matt, is the line, the history line, where the Dodgers and the fight with Walter O'Malley and Robert Moses. The Dodgers leave, the Mets are born, Shea Stadium's born after they spend a couple of years in the Polo Grounds. Shea Stadium, that should have been the new Ebbets Field. Is that a fair way of putting it?
Yeah, that is the place they took Walter O'Malley to say, okay, you want a new stadium? This is where it's going to be. And he did not want it there. You know, A, it wasn't in Brooklyn, and B, they, you know, he came up with a better plan that worked much better for the Dodgers. And along the way, coerced the Giants into joining him, because it would have been a much more difficult situation to set up, especially with, you know, how much longer it took to fly and travel places to have the Giants out there. So a team, you know, going out to California had two stops to make instead of just one. It would have been, but he didn't want it there. And Robert Moses wasn't going to bend. And, you know, the Mets, their biggest hurdle was to try and get National League Baseball back. And they jumped through a lot of hoops to try and do that, and even, you know, sort of faked out the National League by, you know, saying they were going to start a new league. And they never questioned that was where they were going to be. And New York sort of did everything it had to change some of the rules in order to have a publicly funded stadium, which was the thing that made the Mets reality.
I don't know if the Dodgers would have worked, or the fan base would have worked, going out to Queens. What are your thoughts, having done the research? And obviously it was a better scenario for the fans than them going 3,000 miles away to LA, but can't argue with that move now, all these years later. But do you think it would have worked, putting the Dodgers in Queens and calling them the Brooklyn Dodgers? It would have been a bit clumsy.
Well, I mean, you know, you have the New York Giants and the New York Jets playing in New Jersey. It seems clumsier to me, but you know, at the time, I do think it would have rubbed some people the wrong way. But also, in the, you know, late 50s, there was a lot of people that were moving from Brooklyn to other areas, whether it was Queens or Westchester or New Jersey, Connecticut, wherever. So maybe it would have, you know, would have worked out all right. I mean, the biggest hurdle that they had, and one of the things the Mets helped overcome, was expansionitis, which Major League Baseball had, and none of the other leagues had really expanded, other than maybe basketball, which was still in its infancy, until, you know, the early 60s. And then the Mets actually came in a year after the American League expansion. One thing I did learn from doing this, although probably learned it a little while ago, but it always amazes me that the National League was still playing 154 games in 1961, while the American League was playing 162, and they didn't join the 162 movement until the following year when the Mets came in, which enabled the Mets to lose 120 games, which you know, is easier with another 8 games added on there. And just all the things that are going on in baseball now, that if they just left it at 154 games, I think the season would be a little less clumsy. There might even be more playoffs. You know, you wouldn't be having teams necessarily playing when it's, you know, 25 degrees out at night in, you know, city gets, you know, Boston, or God help you if the Twins ever made it in their night games out there.
Absolutely. Matt Silverman joining me, author of the book, Shea Stadium Remembered. We talked earlier about the Mets, you know, and how they were born and the Dodgers leaving, but the field was named after William Shea. And I don't think he gets a lot of press or publicity a lot of the times, even when the ballpark was up. Shea Stadium was just a name, Shea Stadium, to a lot of fans. But he's the guy who got National League Baseball back to New York, and hence why the stadium was named Shea Stadium.
Yes, he did the all the dirty work. They you know, his law practice actually suffered as well. But he was a doer, you know, the type of person that you put in charge of something, you want to get it done, and knew all of, you know, I wouldn't say where the bodies were buried, but knew how to coerce people and, you know, tit for tat and all the other stuff that a New York lawyer back in like the Mad Men era was able to do. And, you know, the Mets ownership doesn't always get a lot of credit, but even he said that, you know, 5 minutes after he died, they would be naming it after some corporate name, and they never did change it. And actually they, you know, at the time, you know, all the other stadiums, a lot of the other stadiums, Riverfront Stadium changed the name, and Jack Murphy Stadium, named after Bob Murphy's brother, changed the name. And Shea, it remained until the day it closed, and they even retired the name and put the Shea Bridge, which, you know, the Citi Field was criticized initially for not having a lot of, you know, stuff coming over from Shea, but they did have the Shea Bridge, and they did have, you know, the Apple, as well as some other things that came over from there. And for a while, those were really the main things that were brought over from Shea, until they sort of have made it more Mets history centric since then.
Obviously, the Mets are Shea Stadium. They're the reason the ballpark was built. But there are a lot of non-sporting events that you chat about in this book. That must have been fun for you. I mean, what are some of the things that you took away from some of those non-Mets Jets events that marked the history of Shea?
Well, you know, it was a municipal stadium, so they the Mets had a lot of say in it, because they had they were the raison d'etre for Shea Stadium, so that, you know, they always kind of hold the Jets over a barrel with that. But they had a lot of concerts. They had the first you know, sort of a landmark stadium concert of its type when the Beatles came. And despite not having that many concerts, I think, you know, Giant Stadium had way more concerts over its life. Shea, you know, is renowned for that. You would have people from England didn't even know what baseball was, but they knew Shea Stadium because the Beatles had played there. And then later the Who played there, and, you know, other bands, Rolling Stones played there, Bruce Springsteen, you know. It didn't have as many acts as a lot of places did, but most of them were, you know, grade A, you know, top of the line. And then Billy Joel, as the final concert, orchestrated that and had Paul McCartney come in and play the last song, which was fitting.
One of the things I think always hurts Shea, and maybe hurts City Field a little bit, I know they're trying to work on it, and it has a political component to it, is that it was literally it's in the middle of nowhere, Shea Stadium. You had the chop shops across the street. I think in your book you have an overhead of before it was built, it was what, a dump?
It literally was a dump, yes.
Like
yeah.
It was a dump, right? So, you know, you're building a stadium in a dump. I get it, you know, open it, you know, area, you know, real estate stuff to come by in New York. There's politics for a publicly funded stadium. I get it. But when I went to Pittsburgh and I've gone to some other areas where they have that ambiance around the stadium, I always say, imagine if the Mets had this around Citi Field or Shea Stadium. I think the ballpark, both ballparks would be looked at differently. What are your thoughts on that?
I do think there's something to be said about that. I don't know that it works around there because, you know, they had the, I've been to other stadiums where they had lots of stuff going on, but, it doesn't seem like whenever I'm there, it's like the place clears out as soon as the game's over. Maybe that's because there's not that much to do there. There is a lot going on there. There's just not that much going on directly, you know, in the quarter mile or half mile around Shea. I mean, even Tommy Agee had a bar there that didn't do well. McFadden's is there, but that's really the only place of its type. You know, that may change, but it is, you know, if you're nostalgic about the city, I guess you need to be, you can be nostalgic about all those the salvage yards, which were there before the Mets arrived and are still there now.
Absolutely. A couple of things before I let you go. You know, if you go, and I don't know if you've ever done that, and look at the original plans for Citi Field, it's so different. I think it was 1997 or 98 when they started talking about a new ballpark. Then 9/11 happened. That had to obviously, for good reason, table the ballpark. But it was supposed to be a retractable dome. I mean, it's almost like Citi Field, what has been born, out of the 2.0 Shea Stadium is totally different than the original plan. I don't know if you've ever done any research on that or looked at that.
Yeah, I did. I did look at that. And also at the original Shea Stadium, I mean, I have a scorecard from 1962 and the mock-up they have of the new stadium, which I don't think was called Shea. They said it was going to be a dome stadium. So that didn't happen. And the same with this, you know, in both cases, it makes a lot of sense because a city like New York should be able to have something that opens up like, you know, a lot of smaller cities have, where you can have the Final Four, you could have the Super Bowl, lots of other stuff, but it just didn't work out. And a lot of it, whether it was 1960 or you know, the year 2006, it was about money, that it cost a lot more to put on a roof, and it just didn't happen. And after they had all the plans ready for in 2001, and then they were all scrapped, that I think they just took what they could do, and they had a promise. And one of the things that that helped get it there was the Olympic bid they had. That was controversial in its own right, that they would expand it if they needed to, even though everyone knew that it probably wasn't going to happen. So I guess domed stadiums in New York is just not meant to be, but having seen other ones that once you have a dome stadium in place, it's nice to have, but the players and a lot of other people, you end up playing a lot of games indoors on nice nights where you could, you know, when you're sitting in the upper deck at Citi Field, you can see the sunset, and there's a lot of nice views like that at Shea Stadium too. And if Shea had been built with, roof on it, they would have invented AstroTurf that many years earlier.
Yeah, that's for sure. Before I let you go, what for you personally is your Citi Field memory? It may not be something that's, you know, the most public or the most dynamic, but it meant something to Matt Silverman.
You mean Citi Field or Shea Stadium?
Shea Stadium. I'm sorry, Shea Stadium.
Okay. Let's see. Because, I would have to think that the best game I went to was the first playoff game they had that I was able to go to was in 1986, the game three against the Astros. And the series was tied, and Lenny Dykstra, they were down, they were trailing for much of the game, and Lenny Dykstra hit the home run that won the game. And that, I was also there for the Grand Slam single game, but the fact that it was 86 and Lenny Dykstra and they never had a playoff game in my lifetime there made that one stand out for me. Although going to the 2015 World Series game 3 there at Citi Field was the one time that I really felt full on buzz this place is something's happening here, which you don't always get at Citi Field just because it's sort of a different vibe and people are different than they were during Shea's heyday. But one day maybe we'll be old enough to live long enough to write a book about Citi Field and its grand history.
That's for sure. So what do you got going on? I mean, you got MetSilverman.com, at Met Silverman on Twitter. The book is Shea Stadium, Remember the Mets, the Jets, and Beatlemania. Give the listeners an idea of what you have coming up. Obviously, if there's anything you want to pop about the book, events, what have you.
Well, that's a good point. I'm actually going to Cooperstown and speaking at the Hall of Fame on this Wednesday, June the 5th at 1:00. That's sort of, Father's Day is a big day for books about sports and baseball in particular. And so, anyone who's interested, they can contact me through MetSilverman.com if they want a autographed copy for their dad or their mom. Or whomever, or they can, buy the book, send it to me if they want, or contact me that way, or just pick it up and read it. And that's just dandy too.
Listen, it's been fun going down memory lane. This is a great book. You did great work on this because I was really enjoying it. You learned something. It brings back great memories. Let's catch up again. Thank you so much for being generous with your time on a weekend. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks a lot, Mike. Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Thanks a lot. That's Matt Silverman at Matt Silverman on Twitter, MattSilverman.com. The book is Shea Stadium Remembered, The Mets, the Jets, and Beatlemania. We'll be back with more Talking Mets podcast, and we'll wrap up right after this.
Hey, Mets fans, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. If you're looking for the best unbiased and independent coverage of the New York Mets, then look no further than MetsmerizedOnline.com. Mesmerized Online is the go-to place for comprehensive Mets coverage, including exclusive interviews, daily original articles, great weekly features, in-depth analysis, minor league reports, game-by-game breakdowns, and so much more. Find out why thousands of fans turn to Mesmerized Online every day to get the latest news and opinions about the Mets. Coming from an impressive staff of the most passionate fans and skilled writers ever assembled, all in one place. Check it out for yourselves, Mets fans. Go to MesmerizedOnline.com. Right now, that's Mets, MERIZED, online.com, and get mesmerized today.
All right, we're back. Final thoughts about interesting trip going down memory lane with Matt Silverman, and I'll leave you guys with this before we wrap up. I always get asked, well, what's your favorite Shea Stadium memory? And I was at the final game at Shea, which was a surreal day, the day they were trying to get into the postseason. They had all these former Mets there. It was raining. They were playing Miami. They had just come off a big win with Santana shutting the Marlins down the day before. And you knew this was could potentially be a great day or it could be an awful day. And then you're trying to celebrate after the game one of those two outcomes and move forward. And I always thought it was an odd situation. It was so that period of time when the Mets went through 06, 07, 08 and all the drama that led to, I guess, the more drama with Omar Minaya getting fired and led to Sandy Alderson was really all coming to a head at that point. And I was at that day. And that's not the most memorable. It was an odd day. It was a memorable day, but for the wrong reasons. But I always go back to Game 3 of the 2000 NLDS, the Benny Agmaiani game. And I was at postseason games in 99, and I went to a few postseason games. I went to a game against the Cardinals later in that postseason in 2000. Had been to a number of games in 06 and over the years. Just tons of games. It's hard to remember every one. And I will just say that that night stood out because it was a dramatic game. I was sitting in the upper deck of Shea Stadium, literally the last row. The wind was whipping. It was so cold. It was such a long game. And you just hope on a game like that, especially because it's a pivotal game in a five-game series. Those game threes in a five-game series, you don't want to lose them because you're down 2-1. Now your back's against the wall. You know you're going back to San Francisco at that point for pivotal, you know, for decisive game five. Tough place to play. They barely survived it the first time. And it was just amazing when Agbayani hit the home run. It was like a combination of joy and relief. And I just want to get out of here. I'm so cold. And you knew they had to turn it around quick because there was a late afternoon game the following day. And the Giants were a team that won 100 games, I believe, that year and were a really tough team. And to navigate with the bullpen, the Mets had a very strong bullpen, getting through that lineup a few times, basically almost playing a game and a half to get through that lineup. It's just the one memory that sticks out to me. I always remember the crack of the bat, seeing Bonds. What I remember the most was not that I was following the ball, because you didn't know if it was going to go out. Shea Stadium, similar to City Field, the ball used to just die. And you're looking at Bonds, and you're looking at Bonds, and then when he turns around and looks, you know that ball's going. And then I just remember seeing the scrum at home plate, the celebration, and the Mets going up 2-1 and putting themselves in a position to win the series, which they did a day later. So that's my Shea Stadium memory, if you want to throw one of those in there. I think I've talked about that on the show before, but I figured I'd throw that out there to end the program on a high note. We will be back on Sunday. We will be doing a draft show on Sunday, kind of recapping the draft, which is currently ongoing. We're also going to take a look at where the Mets farm system is now, and how Sandy Alderson did, because now his drafts from 11 and 12 are the seasons that could potentially lead to the Mets having some players on the roster of either impact or importance, maybe even draft like, you know, 13, 14. Let's take a look at that, because it's interesting for us to see, you know, do the Mets have some things here that can help them this season? There's some arms that they acquired via trade or drafted that may be able to help this bullpen that's struggling. Doesn't seem like there's too much offense left to help them right now in terms of young talent. So it looks that's probably why they're going offense early in the first round this year. That's something that the team, you know, clearly needs work on up throughout the system in a lot of ways. But our old friend who now works for SNY, SNY's Mets blog, Joe DeMeo, will be joining us on Sunday. So stay tuned for that. I think that's going to be a fun segment. It's been a while since we talked to Joe. I've done tons of stuff with Joe over the years, when he just was some kid doing prospects that I had a chance to meet in a Mets chat room, that now he's doing work for SNY and one of the more respected names out there in the Mets fandom that they look to as far as what his opinion is on these prospects and drafts. And he's done so much work to get not only good information, but get to know these guys, get to understand the process. So I'm looking forward to that because Joe's been a friend. He did some work for me at the old nybaseballdigest.com, and now he's going to come on and contribute to this program, and I know that's going to be a fun segment, and I know you guys are going to enjoy that. So stay tuned for that. That'll be coming out on Sunday, and away we go. So I want to thank Matt Silverman for joining us today. You can check him out on Twitter, at Matt Silverman, and then go to his book, Shea Stadium Remembered, The Mets, the Jets, and Beatlemania. Check it out at a bookstore, Amazon, whatever. I want to thank the good folks over at MetsMorizedOnline.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media, and you get the show on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your week. We'll be back with more Talking Mets podcasts later on this week. Take care, everybody.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.